weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, professor and head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, in for Maddie Stover this week.
And I'm Jeff Frame, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. From a Gulf Coast snowstorm and an EF5 tornado to Southern California wildfires and Texas floods, 2025 has been an eventful year for extreme weather, including here in Illinois.
Today, there are at least three major fires and several smaller fires in the greater Los Angeles area. That's according to
the... Tonight, the death toll from the Central Texas floods is now at least 131 people.
When I woke up at 3:30, the water was already in my RV and sweeping everybody downstream.
He remembers the scream.
We are in Catherine Hall in Montego Bay, not too far from the sea. And this entire area was ravaged by Hurricane Melissa. They had flooding.
Got a pretty good winter storm ripping through central Illinois, big portion of the Midwest. High winds out of the southeast feeding into the storm system. The area of low pressure off to the northwest right now, and then we'll get strong west.
We are live from Gaze Memorial Stadium. We're usually down on the field. You can probably see why we're not down on the field. Maybe you could have already guessed that. We're trying to stay out of the wind and snow and everything else and cold.
To talk about standout weather events of 2025, we are pleased to have Andrew Pritchard, meteorologist at Nutrien Ag Solutions and familiar voice here on WILL. Thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Always happy to be here.
So we're going to go through a list of events in chronological order and stay tuned for some of our local events that impacted weather here in central Illinois. Let's start first with the biggest weather disaster of the year.
People in the Los Angeles region are bracing for another day of what the National Weather Service calls a particularly dangerous situation. That is a rare warning beyond the typical red flag conditions and signifies the kind of high winds and low humidity that has led to what's projected to be the most damaging wildfire in American history.
Across the Los Angeles region, the skies were covered in smoke as fast-growing wildfires spread from winds that gusted to nearly 100 miles per hour.
At least 24 people have died, about two dozen more are missing, and a number of communities have been reduced to ash.
What was the drive up like?
It actually looked apocalyptic. You could see on the left side, which is the west side of the 405, starting to have embers on the horizon with dark smoke. And
so from January 7th through 31st, 2025, a series of 14 destructive wildfires affected the Los Angeles metropolitan area and San Diego County in California. Wildfires led to many people being killed and forced more than 200,000 to evacuate, destroyed more than 18,000 homes and structures, and burned over 57,000 acres of land in total. Jeff, what weather conditions caused these wildfires to be so extreme?
All right, so to understand the meteorology behind these wildfires, I'll say a little bit about the climate of the West Coast and Southern California in general. Unlike here in Illinois, where precipitation regularly falls all year round, in Southern California, most of the rain falls between October and April. So summer and early fall there is very dry every year. And so when you get rain for a period of time, things grow during the wintertime and turn green and then dry out during the summer. And so that naturally leads to a wildfire season, usually in the fall. However, in fall 2024, the rainy season was very late, meaning that the rains that usually come in November and December didn't fall. And so that exacerbated those very dry conditions and led to very quick spread of the wildfires, especially when you get strong wind gusts being funneled through the canyons and over the passes down to the coast. They're called Santa Ana winds there. And a lot of those particular fires were actually human-caused. And I know they have at least one person in custody looking at charges of arson and many other crimes to give him the justice he deserves.
Yeah, so truly devastating event, seeing those pictures of so many people's homes destroyed. Switching a little bit to a fluffier note, later on that month, between January 20th and 22nd, a strong winter storm and blizzard impacted much of the Gulf Coast of the United States. This was the first recorded blizzard recorded on the Gulf Coast.
Wind chill is 10 degrees there right now in South Carolina.
Alabama, the beaches have been blanketed in snow. The same is true in New Orleans in the French Quarter there. They got at least 8 inches of snow. And some parts of Louisiana were issued their first blizzard warning ever.
It is a pretty winter wonderland here all across Acadiana for sure.
States of emergencies were declared in almost every state along the Gulf Coast. Snow accumulations ranged to 6 to 12 inches, and states of Louisiana and Florida recorded their largest single-day snowfall across the state, breaking records that had stood for almost a century. So, Andrew, conditions caused that winter storm we saw in the Gulf. What were they?
Yeah, so we talked recently about winter weather conditions here, kind of discussing the winter storm events we've seen in the Midwest early this season. And we talked a bit about the polar vortex. And if we go back to January, we saw a disruption in the polar vortex that allowed some bitterly cold Arctic air to spill down across the central U.S. and then make it all the way down to the Gulf Coast. So we had a series of really intense cold fronts that delivered that really cold air. And then we had a bit of a frontal boundary there where we had a strong area of low pressure develop and run right through that region. So it was a very strong low pressure system creating a lot of precipitation. And with that cold air in place, a lot of that precipitation was able to fall as snow or in some cases some ice. And down south, they don't deal with this kind of precipitation very often. So they simply don't have the infrastructure to keep up with it. And so it doesn't take much to create an emergency situation down there.
Yeah, coincidentally, the snowstorm in New Orleans occurred the week after the American Meteorological Society had their annual meeting down there. I was down there for that. I know, Steve, you were down there as well. And after we got back, I remember talking to some of the students about this in class, and they said, oh, boy, it would have been really cool, if we would have been down there to experience snow in New Orleans. And I said, no, wait a second. New Orleans doesn't have a single snowplow or salt truck because, like Andrew said, it's not cost effective to maintain this equipment when you use it once every 5 or 10 years. And so the whole city was shut down. Everything was sheets of ice for a couple days, and places were just closed. I don't know what we would have eaten had we been down there.
Yeah, a little extra ice in your cocktail on Bourbon Street, I guess.
Absolutely.
Most of the counties are still assessing the full extent of the damage, but preliminary reports indicate impacts to homes, trees, power lines, and roadways due to wind gusts, hail, tornadoes, and flash flooding.
Yeah, so spring into early summer was a busy tornado season, and starting off with the mid-March tornado outbreak, this was the largest tornado outbreak on record for the month of March, with 118 tornadoes, including two EF4 tornadoes that were recorded in Arkansas. It was also the costliest tornado outbreak on record, with an estimated $11 billion of damage, and there were at least 43 fatalities. So probably not a surprise our insurance is going up. Jeff, remind us how a tornado forms.
Yeah, most tornadoes, including those in Arkansas during this outbreak, form from what are called supercell thunderstorms. They're large, they're rotating thunderstorms about 10 to 20 miles across, and they have that signature hook echo usually on their southwestern side. And these form in environments with warm, moist air at the surface, cold air aloft, and then strong wind shear, that is, winds that are changing speed and direction with height. And that allows the storm to rotate. And then to get a tornado, to put it very simply, or maybe even too simply, you need a downdraft to bring some of that rotation from aloft down to the surface. And then that broadly rotating air enters the updraft and is stretched, much like a figure skater bringing her arms in. She's going to spin faster. Well, the same process happens here. And that's how a lot of tornadoes form. But the couple tornadoes we saw in central Illinois during March actually didn't form that way. They formed out of lines of storms. I remember watching one of them. We actually had a downburst. A little rotation developed at the leading edge of that, and I think that was stretched by the updraft. That was the Tolono tornado that we'll get to in a minute.
Meteorologist Andrew Pritchard is on the phone with us.
Right now, I can tell you that the circulation that we've been watching here continues to track northeast. It is kind of on the...
So, Andrew, you and Reginald were covering this live. Can you talk about your experience covering it and what impacts we experienced here in central Illinois?
Certainly. Well, this was in central Illinois, an after dark event. Much of this severe weather moved through after 9 p.m., kind of between 10 p.m. and 1 o'clock that morning. So this was a situation where you couldn't really see much if you were out there as a storm spotter, a storm chaser, or the general public. I did kind of position myself as I was providing live coverage on the south side of Champaign-Urbana, just kind of using the city lights to kind of light up the storms. They're not really expecting to see anything, but kind of deciding that would be where I'd place myself as we provided this live coverage. So Reginald was in the studio. I was in my vehicle just south of town. And, you know, there wasn't much to see besides a lot of heavy rain and some lightning there with the sirens going. It was a bit of an ominous mood there. But it wasn't until the next day that daylight came out and we were able to actually survey, like Jeff said, some of these circulations that developed within that line, and were able to confirm a couple tornadoes did touch down locally.
So, Andrew, what caused this large outbreak?
Well, again, like Jeff said, we had kind of a multiple modes of storms here. So we had down south kind of a more classic outbreak of supercells that were producing more significant and long-lived tornadoes. And then a little bit further north, where you had a little bit less instability but still had a lot of wind shear from this very powerful storm system. That is to say, you know, very strong winds aloft, and then we had very strong winds down near the surface as well with that warm and moist air. But a little bit different ingredients, you get a different storm mode. So we had these lines of storms moving through that were producing widespread severe winds, but then also had some embedded areas of rotation and were able to produce a few tornadoes as well. So you get into the springtime here, this time of year, it's very classic timing to get these big storm systems that can produce a widespread severe weather event that can span several states and several days sometimes.
Yeah, usually when I'm thinking March, I'm not thinking about tornadoes, but seems like this is certainly a possibility here in the Midwest. Jeff, can you comment on, you know, mid-March here in central Illinois? I mean, are we considered in Tornado Alley at that time? Or?
Well, Tornado Alley has no set definition, but it's kind of the region of the United States, a lot of the central United States where tornadoes are most common. So sometimes it stretches, people will draw it here into Illinois. But generally kind of centered from Iowa and then back into a lot of the central plains, maybe as far north as the Dakotas. And then certainly, of course, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, your traditional hotspot. But there's another big area that's not really included in that that sees a lot of tornadoes and probably more significant tornadoes in the plains. And that was impacted during this outbreak down across the lower Mississippi Valley. So Missouri, parts of Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama. And they were impacted not only that on the 14th, but also on March 15th, when the Storm Prediction Center issued a rare high risk for severe weather, one of two they issued last year across that area. But here in Illinois, tornadoes in March are not unusual. You only have to go back to March 31st, 2023. That was the third largest tornado outbreak in U.S. history, and Illinois saw more tornadoes with that event than any other state. And there were over 100 tornadoes confirmed in total.
So you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather here in Illinois. We're talking about weather highlights of 2025 with Andrew Pritchard, meteorologist at Nutrien Ag Solutions. So Andrew, as usual, you had a pretty eventful storm chasing season and you have a pretty strong presence on social media, and I always enjoy your videos.
It's 5:56 p.m. We just had a long-lived tornado from this beautifully structured supercell. You can see the anvil here, the entire updraft. That's the tornadic region right there. The tornado is roped out, but I can still see a little notch there where it looks like it may try to spin back up.
Incredible. So what are you looking for when you chase, and what kind of storms do you follow?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've just really liked videotaping storms. And so when I was younger, I could only do that from the front doorstep. But you get older and you can drive a car and you can get yourself to some of these storms. So first and foremost, I'm trying to forecast where I can go and have an enjoyable experience with the storm and film it. So, you know, you're looking for that combination of instability and wind shear. And, you know, I don't love the fast moving storms in the early spring or the overnight thunderstorms. I prefer that combination of something that's, you know, very severe, something you don't see every day, but something that's also going to provide an opportunity to put a camera on it and feel relatively safe when I'm doing so.
So what are some standout moments, maybe your top two chases?
Yeah, so if we're just kind of sticking to this year, we had a couple of good ones. If I go back to May 16th, I observed a couple of tornadoes in the Sikeston, Missouri area, and both of these were moving at reasonable speeds of around 30 miles per hour. So they were very photogenic, not a lot of precipitation around them. I was able to film their entire lifespan. Yeah, there's a tornado in there. There was a tornado in there just past my west. And then if you go to July 16th up in Wisconsin, this was kind of a classic Midwestern summertime severe weather setup. And what I liked about this storm was they were a little bit smaller and slower moving. So I was able to get kind of close and got really dramatic video of an EF0 tornado that was throwing a lot of tree debris up in the air there. So it's nice when you can get a little closer and feel safe when you do so. So I love a good slow moving summer storm.
So speaking of May 16th, this was an incredible day across the area. We experienced some pretty rare conditions, tornadoes in St. Louis, and then a dust storm that extended up from I-74 through Chicago.
It is the first time a dust storm warning has been issued in the city.
In fact, this dust storm today, the last time Chicago experienced a dust storm like this one was back in 1934 on May 10th, and that was during the Dust Bowl.
Families out on familiar promenades looking up and not seeing the skyline they expected.
We're from the Middle East, so this is something that we've seen before over there, but not over here.
The National Weather
Blowing
Service
dust made travel dangerous, with some areas of Illinois experiencing zero visibility, including areas of downtown Chicago. High wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour also caused wind damage in southern parts of the state. So, Jeff, what was the connection here? Why was it such an unusual day?
Yeah, so if we go back to the previous day, May 15th, we had some storms in the area, and those storms shoved a cold front farther south down toward I-70 in the St. Louis area. And so that really cleared out a lot of that moisture that we would need for tornadoes, at least in central Illinois, not so down in St. Louis and a lot of parts of Missouri where Andrew was.
In the days after the storm, St. Louis turned out to help.
Like, if you never saw Mother Nature's worst, this is what it looks like. I mean, like, houses collapsed, trees that's been around forever, felled over power lines.
The National Weather Service says a tornado seems to have touched down near Clayton, then cut a path northwest through Forest Park, the Central West End, then North City into Illinois. At times, the Weather Service says the tornado was up to a mile wide. As the region turns to recover.
Moving to Jeff's pick for his favorite weather event of 2025, the Wellfleet, Nebraska tornado on June 16th. Jeff, you chased this tornado. Can you tell us about how that chase went and what the tornado was like?
Yeah, so this happened during my summer field studies of convection course that I lead every year at the University of Illinois, where I take several of our atmospheric sciences students out in a large university van, and we look at the weather every morning and look at the weather for the coming days and make our forecast and drive out there and observe what the atmosphere does. But we do it safely and from a safe distance. We're not driving into anything. We try to stay out of the large hail and things like that. And I'm not just saying this because you're my department head. But that day really didn't shout tornadoes at me. Really, the only reason we were there is because the day before we were chasing storms out in northeastern Colorado, and the next day looked like a pretty high-end severe weather event down in southern Kansas. The primary tornado target that day was actually all the way up in Minnesota, but we weren't sold on that either. So you're talking about driving 10 hours one way and then 10 hours back the other way. So I said, well, no, that's not worth it, and that's not really safe either. So we chased Nebraska, and we sat around most of the afternoon under the hot June sun, and then a storm just exploded south of the town of North Platte. Looked really pretty, very photogenic, very slow moving. And then it put down a little funnel in a brief tornado, and that tornado surprisingly persisted for about 45 to 50 minutes. With beautiful storm structure above it. And the best part of this tornado is that it hit nothing except for a few trees and power lines.
From a wide funnel that got even wider high above a rainbow to this thinner, almost opaque funnel surrounded by clear skies. Storm chasers also got close enough to see the swirling debris on the ground. There were no immediate.
So, Andrew, how do you choose which storms to chase?
Well, Jeff said a couple key words there, slow moving and photogenic. If you got the opportunity to have a storm that's all by itself, you're going to have a much better chance to observe the different storm features there. And the slower moving it is, the better chance you're going to have to get out and observe it. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than having a very cool storm that's right on your tails the whole time. You have to spend most of the storm chase driving with your back to it potentially. So getting to stand out there and observe a nice, clean, supercell thunderstorm where you can really observe all the features there is really kind of the dream scenario.
And Jeff, what safety precautions do you need to take, and should I recommend people just go out and start doing this?
Storm chasing is something that even if you've taken courses in meteorology, no amount of coursework, even if you got an A in that class, is going to prepare you to storm chase safely. The number one danger is just driving. You know, we drive thousands of miles in those 2 weeks. I do have a teaching assistant to help me with the driving. And, you know, there are two of us there co-leading the trip. We have somebody driving and we have somebody looking at radar, looking at the storm, looking at the map. When you're tracking a storm, Google Maps does not know where it's going. You can't rely on a lot of these navigation aids. It'll take you into the core of the storm. It might take you in the path of the tornado. It might take you on a muddy dirt road. There are a lot of things that can go wrong with that. Now, you can dial up a lot of videos on YouTube, and you'll see people getting very close and taking this extreme video. But again, that's very, very dangerous. And especially with my big group of students, right, if you're in a van with eight other people, you can't see very well out the windshield. So we prefer to be far enough away where we can get out, watch the storm. We're not getting rained on. We're not getting hailed on. And of course, we're out of the risk of lightning, which you can't get out of the way of.
So 2025 also saw the first EF5 tornado in the United States since 2013. Jeff, can you tell us more about this tornado?
Yeah, this tornado hit the small town of Enderlin in eastern North Dakota at about 11 p.m. on Friday, June 20th. This also fell during that same field course, but we had targeted a storm out in the western Dakotas that day, again, out of a preponderance of safety. Because another thing we don't do is try to chase storms after dark. You really can't see anything. Your mind can play all kinds of tricks on you. If you want something to be a wall cloud, your mind will make that thing a wall cloud or a tornado. And we've actually been under tornado warnings in other years where people have mistaken low-hanging clouds for tornadoes, and we're standing there at this gas station getting dinner, and it's like, well, we got to get out of here because bad things are going to happen in about 20 minutes. But this storm formed pretty late in the evening in a very favorable environment there in eastern North Dakota, and it was one of several tornadoes that occurred. And this tornado wasn't up to an EF5. It was initially rated an EF3. It wasn't up to an EF5 for a few months after the fact. When the National Weather Service in Grand Forks, North Dakota, did a damage analysis, and really this was based on a full train car that was thrown several hundred yards into a field, and they determined that it requires over 200-mile-an-hour winds to do that, and 200-mile-an-hour winds is the threshold for an EF5. And then later that same evening, a large derecho or bowing line of storms capable of significant and widespread wind damage produced 100-mile-an-hour wind gusts over that same area. And that was a big reason why I took my students out west, because I didn't want to get blown around by that at midnight.
So we'll wrap up this segment with the discussion of another really extreme event that hit Texas Hill Country on July 4th of this year. Very early hours of the morning, the Guadalupe River rose 26 feet in 45 minutes. As a result, at least 135 people were killed.
Tonight, the death toll from the Central Texas floods is now at least 131 people. Officials worry it could be more than double that amount, with little to no rescue since last week.
I don't want to say I accepted it, but no, I mean, I thought I was going to die.
Leo Romero never went to sleep the night of July 3rd.
You know, I was awake all night playing just like, you know, games.
Around 6 a.m. on July 4th, he heard the water. His father told Leo and his stepmother, Natalia, to climb onto the couch, grab the curtains. Leo Sr. held his toddler son in the air.
how I recall it, is the roof fell, but you know, just next thing I know, house is gone, so I'm just in the water.
When I woke up at 3:30, the water was already in my RV and sweeping everybody downstream.
He remembers the screams, the people begging for help.
Flung my hand up and my neighbor grabbed me and pulled me out.
Jeff, can you tell us more about this weather event?
A tropical storm had hit Mexico a few days earlier, and then kind of the remnant low spun over Texas, and it just sat there. It was very slow-moving, kind of typical summertime weather pattern with fairly weak winds, and thunderstorms developed around that low on the night of July 3rd, and these really trained over the same area and produced copious amounts of rain, 6 to 10 or more inches of rain in some areas. And this is the Texas Hill Country, so that rain falls on the hills and it all runs down into the valleys. And what flows through the valleys, of course, are rivers. And so this resulted in these walls of water sweeping along those rivers there in Texas. And this ended up being actually deadlier than the floods caused by Hurricane Helene in the Carolinas in September 2024.
So for those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Steve Nesbitt.
And I'm Jeff Frame, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois.
If you have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we're talking about the hurricanes, the heat waves, the drought of 2025. We're talking about the weather highlights of the year, as well as what weather to expect in the last few weeks here of 2025. From the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media, welcome back to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the science behind weather and climate in Illinois. I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, professor and head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Illinois.
And I'm Jeff Frame, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois.
So we're going to get into the second half of the year, and we'll try not to get too much into dry humor here, but we will talk about dryness. The summer in central Illinois was characterized by a lack of extreme weather, and Champaign-Urbana has not been under a severe thunderstorm watch all year. Andrew, what sort of severe weather do we typically see or hear in summer, and why didn't we see it this year?
So during the summertime, the jet stream typically weakens and begins to shift a little bit further north up toward the Canadian border. So during the summer months here in central Illinois, we usually see our severe weather come in a couple of different forms. And the most common one is our afternoon pulse thunderstorms we get on a hot, humid day. Those are the storms that go up very quickly and they kind of rain themselves out. And those can produce locally severe winds. Sometimes they can produce some severe weather or some severe hail, I should say, and some locally heavy rainfall and flash flood risks. And then the other thing that can happen is sometimes we do get little subtle jet stream disturbances here. We can get into the right pattern where we can get, you know, thunderstorm clusters to develop across the area and more organized severe weather events. Typically our squall lines, our bow echoes, and this is usually when we would find ourselves in derecho season where we would get our what I call big mean windbacks, but our bow echoes that come through and produce sometimes very widespread severe weather. So we did experience a very hot and muggy summer, so we did have those pulse thunderstorms going up at times, producing very localized severe weather events. But what we didn't have was, you know, those jet stream disturbances making their way in, giving us the more organized severe weather events, the more widespread rainfall. And that was really because of a ridge of high pressure that developed across the central United States and just did not allow those jet stream disturbances to make their way in. They were kind of deflected northward up into the Canadian prairies. So just did not have the ingredients for more widespread severe weather and rainfall as we got into the summer months.
Yeah, I think a lot of research shows that those organized storms typically produce almost 70% of our rainfall. So when those are missing from the equation, that can really potentially cause drought over some regions.
Yeah, we badly need those summertime thunderstorm clusters.
So we did, however, see some flash flooding events in Illinois with some of those pulse events. First was July 8th. During an evening, a stationary thunderstorm produced localized flash flooding in west central Chicago.
The near west side may have gotten the worst of it.
Close to 5.5 inches of rain that Chicago received in about 3 hours. It made many underpasses impassable and in some cases waist deep.
It was bad. It was like heavy.
One rain gauge west of the United Center measured over 5 inches of rain in just 90 minutes. Jeff, what is a stationary thunderstorm?
Yeah, stationary thunderstorms are a lot like these pulse storms that Andrew just talked about. In the summer, as Andrew also mentioned, the jet stream weakens and shifts north into Canada. Now, the jet stream gets its energy between the temperature contrast between the warm air in the tropics and colder air closer to the North Pole. Well, as you go from winter into summer, the warm air gets a little bit warmer down to the south, but the cold air up in Canada and the Arctic really warms up between winter and summer. And so with the weaker jet stream, the steering winds for these storms can be a lot weaker. And it's not unusual at all, July into August, that I'll wake up in the morning and check the news and, you know, a couple times a year, some random town, either in Kentucky or Missouri or Texas, saw 8 inches or more of rain. And maybe even the other side of a county maybe only saw an inch or two of rain, which is wet, but certainly nothing catastrophic. And because these storms tend to be pretty small scale, they tend to be pretty unpredictable. One thing we see with predictability in the atmosphere is that the larger something is, the more predictable it is, and the smaller something is, the less predictability it is. And with this particular event occurring in west central Chicago, it was compounded by the urban environment because the pavement and so forth is unable to soak in a lot of that water. So it either goes into the storm drainage system, which can be overwhelmed, or it runs off into lower areas, causing some of that flash flooding.
The next event took place in the Chicago area August 16th through 17th, where rainfall amounts for multiple rounds of thunderstorms totaled as much as 3 to 6 inches. During that week, there also was a heavy rainfall event that impacted the extreme north side of Champaign, and there was flooding up by North Prospect shopping area.
In the afternoon, there was a downpour. This is at the intersection of Prospect and Bradley Avenues. Water rose very quickly, flooding the area. Several cars stalled and had to be pushed out. Again, this situation.
Whereas down in my house in South Champaign, we barely got a drop. Why is it so hard to predict these localized thunderstorms, Andrew?
Yeah, well, if you kind of think about an oversimplified, let's say, early season severe weather event in the springtime where you've got, you know, a big area of low pressure and a frontal boundary that's going to move through, you've got, you know, central Illinois has this big unstable air mass, you know, across it. And then just kind of imagine a front then moving from west to east across central Illinois. It's kind of going to act as a squeegee moving from west to east or left to right across the weather map there. And you can kind of easily time out, well, as this front moves from west to east across the area between 12 to 4 p.m., those thunderstorms are going to accompany that front and quickly move through the area. And then you get to the summertime of the year where things are just hot, muggy, and stagnant. You've got all of central Illinois is unstable and ready to pop, but there's no front or you know, boundary necessarily that you can say this is where they're going to pop. It's kind of, you just know, today we've got that potential for thunderstorms that are going to tap into a really tropical humid air mass and have the potential to produce very heavy rains, but it becomes kind of what we call a now casting situation where you're looking closely at the hourly weather data, really trying to kind of squint and find any little subtle boundary that might encourage those storms to develop that may be the focal point then for that flash flooding event so you can kind of relay that information. So it's just the details are smaller and, you know, it's harder to kind of pick out where that event's going to happen until it's, you know, almost happening sometimes.
Fast forward a little bit into the early fall. With these recent cold snaps, it's easy to forget that we actually had a heat wave in central Illinois in September and early October. Andrew, what caused this heat wave?
Yeah, this was a widespread event that was caused by the jet stream got weaker during the summertime and it ventured north into Canada. And then as we got toward the back half of the summer, it just didn't want to come back. So we went through a lot of September and October looking at a jet stream that went up and over the lower 48 here and left a big area of high pressure across the central and southern United States. And so that gives a lot of sinking motion then throughout the atmosphere. It suppresses the development of storm systems, of clouds, of rain. So you just end up with a widespread, sunny, and sometimes increasingly warm landscape. So again, this was a widespread event that really just, it was one of the hotter and drier September and October's on record across, again, not just central Illinois, not just the Midwest, but out into the plains and then down across the Gulf Coast. And that was really the catalyst to some of the widespread drought that we're seeing now.
On this day in late September, he's harvesting soybean in Champaign County. He says the dry weather caused yields to take a hit.
There are spots where the drought is not as bad. People got a rain that made a big difference. But for the most part, all of the area farmers have suffered some losses due to the drought.
We've talked about the lack of organized thunderstorms and then this heat wave, and these two things coupled to produce one of the strongest droughts we've seen here in central Illinois. In fact, Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford says that as of today, we need 0.2 inches of precipitation before the end of the year to avoid 2025 being the driest year on record in Champaign-Urbana going back all the way to 1888. Jeff, has this early blast of snow impacted drought conditions here in East Central Illinois?
Yeah, not really, unfortunately. Looking at the current drought monitor that goes from none and then zero up to four, an area right around Champaign County is in D3, which is extreme drought. And then most of the rest of Central Illinois, kind of from Kankakee down to Mattoon or so, and then west toward the Peoria area and west of there, is in a D2 or severe drought with lighter areas surrounding that. Some of the far southern Chicago suburbs, as well as areas kind of south of I-64, are not in drought at all right now. But really, if you look at the snowfall, for example, on December 13th, we measured 5.2 inches of snow here in Champaign-Urbana, but it was a very fluffy snow. If you melt that down, it was only about a third of an inch of liquid. And a third of an inch of rain is hardly a drought buster. So we really need to see some significant precipitation as we go through the winter to help recharge some of that water table. Right? I mean, nothing's actively growing out there right now, but certainly we'd like to recharge the groundwater and get it ready for next year's growing season.
It was the strongest storm to ever hit Jamaica.
Another event that we covered here on Weather Realness on October 28th, Hurricane Melissa made landfall in Jamaica. The storm became the third most intense Atlantic hurricane on record with the highest winds, 1 minute sustained at 185 miles per hour.
Catherine Hall in Montego Bay, not too far from the sea, and this entire area was ravaged by Hurricane Melissa. They had flooding and now the residue of mud up and down the streets.
Before the storm hit Cuba, over 700,000 people took shelter, and just a brave few ventured out today to witness the storm for themselves.
It was hell all night. The winds have been terrible.
So we're just on the outskirts of Santiago de Cuba, and we've come across several scenes like this one, whole orchards of bananas that have just been flat. And this is a big problem for Cuba, which is not producing enough food for its people.
Haiti was spared a direct hit, but one coastal mayor said people were killed in floods after a river burst its banks. Residents in the already
Jeff, can you tell us more about this hurricane and its impacts?
Actually, the hurricane hunters, just before the storm made landfall, deployed an instrument called a drop sonde. It's kind of the inverse of a weather balloon, where they drop it out of an aircraft with a parachute on it, and it measures temperature, moisture, pressure, and wind on its way down. And it recorded a wind gust well over 200 miles an hour, which, if it stands, would be the strongest wind gust ever recorded on Earth. Hurricane Melissa was certainly the most noteworthy storm of the 2025 hurricane season in the Atlantic. 102 people died as a result of that storm, with most of those 53 in Jamaica and another 43 in Haiti, and 141 people were injured. Now, those numbers obviously are tragic, but it could have been very much worse. The Jamaican government really did a good job opening shelters and preparing their citizens for the onslaught of this storm. And again, the storm did not hit Kingston, the capital, but really devastated part of the poorer southwestern coastline of the island, and then actually exited the North Shore near the resort community of Montego Bay. And it caused $10 billion in damage to Jamaica. And then it made landfall in Cuba that night, came across the Bahamas the next day, and then went out into the Atlantic. Here in the United States, we didn't see any hurricane landfalls. Only in early July, Tropical Storm Chantal made landfall as a pretty weak system in the Carolinas. And despite this, out of the 13 named storms in the Atlantic Ocean this year, three of them were Category 5 hurricanes. Melissa, obviously. Also, Hurricane Erin and Hurricane Humberto, which fortunately stayed out to sea and did not directly impact land areas. But that actually ties for the second most Category 5 hurricanes on record in a single season.
So you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather here in Illinois. We're talking about weather highlights of 2025 with Jeff Frame from CLIMAS at the University of Illinois and Andrew Pritchard, meteorologist at Nutrien Ag Solutions. So moving into the fall, November 10th saw lake effect snow and thunder snow in the Chicago area and heavy lake effect snow in northwest Indiana, with a foot of snow recorded in Valparaiso, Indiana.
A true blast of lake effect snow hitting Chicago, Illinois right now. It is coming in sideways.
I'm here on Springfield Ave in just North Champaign area. And like you mentioned, this morning, our wake-up call, our 2 a.m. wake-up call was pretty treacherous.
Big-time snow flurries here already starting to stack up on the car in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, thanks to a band of lake effect snow that extends from Lake Michigan in the Chicago area all the way down Interstate 57 into East
Andrew,
Central,
is it
Illinois.
Unusual to see lake effect snow so early in the year off of Lake Michigan?
I wouldn't say it's unusual. This is kind of, something we can see this time of year if we bring in a really significant cold front. So this was the case here in the second week of November. We brought a lot of cold air south over the Great Lakes, and these lake waters, Lake Michigan specifically, have been cooking in the summertime sun. So, you know, these lake waters are still extremely warm compared to that early season cold air moving over the surface of the lake. So we can generate really intense updrafts and get some really heavy snowfall in these narrow bands that can kind of wobble around with the surface flow there. We saw it at times pointed at the Chicago area and then swinging over towards northwest Indiana and then at times into portions of southern Michigan. But this was kind of your textbook early season, kind of being fall lake effect snow event here in the Great Lakes.
It was kind of a neat event, too, because I think we saw some accumulation here in Champaign-Urbana from some of those bands.
Yeah, we did. And I know we talked about that here in one of our Weather Realness episodes, just a couple of episodes back, talking about how that was able to happen. You get that trajectory of the surface winds kind of blowing a little out of the north-northeast, which is not impossible here in Champaign-Urbana, but it does seem that every time we get that wind out of the northeast, people notice for some reason or another because it's kind of unusual, and this was the case here. We get that lake effect snow and some minor accumulations down here in Champaign County. Again, something that's not impossible, but usually only happens, every few years if we're lucky.
So then on November 29th, the classic Illinois-Northwestern matchup was the snowiest game in Gies Memorial Stadium history with 8 inches of snow. Andrew, you were at the game. What was your experience?
It was unreal, really. I mean, the visuals, you could see the curtains of snow blowing through the lights there. Of course, you had snow all in the stands and people just kind of having a very unusual and fun experience. People were in a great mood. It was Illinois versus Northwestern. Illinois got the win, so that always helps there. But it was cold. I had many, many layers on. The snow was changing over to a kind of sleet and rain mix by the end of it, and it was windy. So it took a little while to thaw off once we got home. But I just knew once we got closer to this game and you could see the weather conditions that would be present that it was going to be an experience that, doesn't happen very often there to get to go hang out at the stadium and enjoy a big snowstorm.
So we've had a pretty snowy late end of the year here. Jeff, how cold and snowy has this December been so far in Illinois?
Yeah, well, we'll even go back to late November and include the event there from November 29th, as well as the lake effect system from earlier that month. So total this snow season so far, we have 18.4 inches of snow accumulation in Champaign-Urbana. And our average for the entire winter season is around 21.4 inches. So if you add all this up and run the numbers, it's the second snowiest start to the winter on record, again, going back to the late 1800s in Champaign-Urbana. And this, and not only that, but persistent cold as well, really going back to Thanksgiving. This has been the fifth coldest first half of December on record. The mean temperature has only been 20.4 degrees. And a couple days ago, we recorded an overnight low of negative 14 and set a record low temperature.
So one of the events that's happening most recently here in weather headlines is extreme flooding in the Pacific Northwest. Can you comment, Jeff, on the causes of this extreme flooding?
Yeah. Again, it comes down to a pretty stagnant weather pattern where we've had a ridge kind of centered across the southwestern U.S. With a trough in the jet stream upstream across the eastern Pacific Ocean. And this has directed a substantial plume of subtropical moisture emanating from the region around Hawaii northeastward into parts of Oregon and especially Washington and British Columbia. Sometimes this is termed the Pineapple Express since it's originating near Hawaii, or sometimes they're called atmospheric rivers because the amount of water vapor being transported through the atmosphere is similar to what you'd see in a major river system like the Mississippi.
Tonight, nearly 50 miles of Highway 2 remained closed after flooding and mudslides washed out parts of the road there.
Not much of Highway 2 is visible in this video sent to us by a viewer.
This is supposed to be the road.
There are slides from Lake Wenatchee to Skykomish, all the way across, and that is about 40 miles of road.
Todd Bruner lives in Skykomish. He's a resident volunteer pitching in to help his town.
Well, it is very wet. We've had 18 inches of rain in the last 3 days. The road's closed to the east, to the west. The railroad's down. We don't have any power. We're on...
And then another thing as well is the Cascade Mountains. There are pretty limited crossings of that. It's not like if you wanted to, you know, say drive from Champaign to Springfield and I-72 is closed. There are about 10 other ways you can do that without adding too much onto your journey.
So bringing this all together, how has this year of severe weather here in Illinois compared to previous years?
Yeah, I don't have the exact stats in front of me, but it's been an interesting year in that across Illinois and across the United States, we got off to a near record pace for severe weather, that being things like tornadoes and severe weather. But then if you look at the whole year, we really slowed down abruptly as we got toward the back half of the summer and the fall. And so that's kind of helped the year overall, again, nationally speaking, fall a little bit closer to average here. It's still going to finish above average.
2025 in general, in terms of temperature, the first half of the year, kind of January through June and even into July, was pretty unremarkable relative to average, with some months like January being a little colder than average and April being a little warmer than average. But again, to see kind of the persistent above average temperatures, again, we kind of have to get into that back half of the year and really fall, September, October, and even given the cold snap around Thanksgiving, really into November, those months were significantly warmer than average. Again, that's kind of consistent with the climate change signal.
All right, well, I hope you all had an extreme 2025, and thank you so much for joining us, Jeff and Andrew.
Always happy to be here.
Great to be here, Steve, and we'll see you next year.
Jeff Frame is a professor in the Department of Climate Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, and Andrew Pritchard is a meteorologist at Nutrien Ag Solutions. You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Steve Nesbitt. If you have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.
Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.